Place it comfortably. So, good morning, everyone. First day of session. Beautiful autumn day in the woodlands. All's right with the world. Before we begin, you may remember from past sessions that I don't formally acknowledge First Nations people and so on. But it's not out of any lack of appreciation for them and their civilization they had. So in my own words, as a way of beginning this session, I would like to for us to just reflect on the Warramai people who lived in this area for thousands and thousands of years before we were here, and enjoyed the same experience of the woodland and the autumn weather and the birds, just like we are today. So, if I could give a title for this talk, it would be The Awakened Life. You may recall in Joko's books, I think it's Every Day Zen near the beginning, is she makes a statement, and I'm paraphrasing it, along the lines that enlightenment is not the gaining of anything. Enlightenment is the absence of something. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't usually use the word enlightenment. It's got a whole lot of connotations to it, but Joko used to use the word the awakened life. You know, so we awaken out of the self-centered dream into the awakening, the awakened life. That's the journey that we're on. But to give you, to say a little bit more about that, it's not the gaining of something, but the absence of something. It's like health. I began this session, you know, having been somewhat unwell for the last few weeks with quite severe sinusitis. And fortunately, I got a little spray that helped it and made quite a big difference the other day, and I feel a whole lot better. But I haven't gained anything. I just lost a lot of symptoms. So I'm not sneezing, there's no hay fever, and the inflammation has gone down. So I was restored to better health. Now, that's kind of like how this practice works. You just get restored to the natural order of life. You don't gain anything. And if you reflect on the Four Noble Truths, which is the Buddha's first teaching he gave after his awakening, there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. It's a medical metaphor. Mm-hmm. It's like there's disease or illness, there's a cause for it. It can be cured, and this is the therapy or the pathway, you know, or the medicine or whatever, which will make that difference. And the word nirvana, you know, to come back to the no gaining of anything. People often think of it, oh, I've gained nirvana, I've gained enlightenment. But the word nirvana literally means the blowing out of something, like the blowing out of a flame. So it's the end of something, you know, the end of all of the symptoms, like a fever that were making you sweat and hot and cold, you know, and agitated. It's like all of that's blown out. No, it's gone away, or it's faded. Mm-hmm. And may I remind you again, in the path that leads to the end of suffering is the Eightfold Noble Path, and it breaks down, I won't go through all of them, because I can never remember all of them, but it breaks down into three components, and those three components are insight, and meditation, and the serenity that is cultivated through meditation, and the precepts, ethics. And in Zen, we refer to that as the three-legged stool of Zen. They're the three components that interact with one another. There's a synergy between the three of them, and those three make up the practice. And if you practice that, if you take that medicine over and over again, then you start to blow out the flame, right, that's causing all of the agitation and suffering in your life. To use another metaphor, is imagine you've had an aching tooth, you know, and it's really, really been bothering you. And you go to the dentist and they take the tooth out, right? And there's an empty space left there, right? And that's like a metaphor for awakening. It's like there's just an empty space left there where there was this sort of ego identity before, right? It's nothing there. And then your tongue keeps going over the empty space and goes, is it really there? That empty space. And you kind of feel into it. So that's kind of the way that it works. And when we talk about the self-centered dream, you know, or ego identity, egocentricity, whatever, well, all it is really is the cycling of greed, hatred and ignorance. Think of it going like the little animals in the middle of the wheel of life. I think it's a pig and a rooster and a snake, right, representing greed, hatred and ignorance. They're just chasing each other's tails like that. And so it creates this kind of fiction of a circle which really exists because of the spinning nature of the wheel. But it doesn't actually exist. You know? And Alan Watts put it so succinctly once, you know, when he said that what we refer to as the ego is just a psychophysical tension. Do you know? It's just this contracting that occurs when we identify with this sort of ego identity. And then we have to hold on to it and defend it and fight for it and et cetera, et cetera. And we create a whole lot of contraction around it, as well as being a nuisance to other people. That's what happens. And the practice is to see through that. Now, when we're sitting on our cushions in a session, what our practice is to just stay present to what's happening, to the suchness of life. And all of us, including me, we sit there and, yeah, we're just with the breath, with the body, with the sounds of the wind in the trees. And then fantasies go through our mind, you know, and they may be passed on around ideals of what we would like to be, or they're based on past resentments or slights of things that have happened in the past. And we may think that fantasy is just benign, but it's not. Because the more that we spin those stories in our mind in everyday life, then the more that they perpetuate the ego identity. They're not benign, really. There are benign fantasies or imaginations of things, but the type of things I'm talking about of that nature, they're not benign. And so when we take time out of our busy lives to do a lot of still, focused sitting meditation, that's our practice, to see that we're spinning all of this stuff and we're at the centre of it somewhere. Mm-hmm. We're spinning it all and it keeps on maintaining our ego identity. But the good thing about session is that we're onto it, right? We can see what we're up to. And when it arises, we notice, instead of following it, pursuing it, indulging it, making it bigger than what it is, just come up, no judgment, back to the practice again. And it's by doing that over and over again that we break down this ego identity and we fall into suchness, right? We fall into life as it is. It's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. Now, also in Zen practice, we hear a lot about, well, Zen is supposed to be the school of sudden enlightenment. And if you've read all of the Zen books, you know, you'll come across many, many stories of people who've had sudden enlightenment experiences where they've kind of woken up in a single incident and it's transformed their life. Now, these things do occur. There's no doubt about that. But my experience is, both personally and having been around Zen teachers and other Zen students and centres for a long time, is that the gradual process of practice is underrated, you know, and the sudden enlightenment experience is somewhat overrated in terms of its transformative experience. Yes, these things do happen, and it's as though people I've found Zen students try to fit their experience into the narrative of what Zen is supposed to be, just like Christians do as well, you know, with the conversion experiences and so on. So people try to fit themselves into the ideal. But sometimes, most of these experiences, they're just glimmers, you know. And we use fancy words for it, like kensho, but the word kensho actually means just a little glimmer. You know, sort of little glimmer of light that you saw for a moment. It doesn't mean some big full-blown experience like presumably the Buddha had, where it just sort of the whole ego identity just shatters completely. It's just a little glimmer. And you'll see through nearly all of the manuals on Zen training, particularly, you know, the main teachers I've had in Robert Aitken and Charlotte Beck, is the importance of polishing the mirror. You know, so it's just a little glimmer and you have to keep working on it. And you have to keep working on it and working on it and working on it. So it's not just that we're all aiming for some sudden insighted experience which is somehow going to transform our character forever. It might. Good luck to you if it happens, right? But for most of us, sometimes these moments of clarity come and they need to be acknowledged, but we don't need to make too much out of them as well. So really, really value the slow, gradual process of Zen. When you're doing that, you're wearing away that ego identity, even though it may not seem like anything's necessarily happening. You do it over time and something gradually wears away. And those kind of energies in yourself that were driving your behaviour and your thinking from 5 years ago, they've faded a lot. They may not ever go completely, but they've faded a lot. So please value that aspect of practice, not just the idealised sudden enlightened experience of it. The other thing to remember about practice too, in the sense of the awakened life being the absence of something, not the gaining of something, is keep thinking metaphorically of your practice as it's a journey and it's no destination. Right? No destination. But you're on a journey. Right? You're going somewhere, right? But will you arrive at a spot and go, oh, yeah, I'm enlightened now. Don't need to do this anymore. It's not quite like that. Because it's the nature of it that it's deepening and deepening. The more you do the practice, the more it deepens over time. Many Zen commentators have looked at, teachings of the Buddha from when he was a young man to when he was old. And even with the Buddha, you can see there's a maturing process comes, you know, something much more subtle, you know, in the teaching develops. So there's a maturing process in the Buddha and there's a maturing process in us as we engage with the practice. Someone said to me, a conversation I was having with someone just before session started, you know, was that no self is the bullseye, you know, that we're aiming at. You know, that's a central component of it. And that's true. I understand the question and the metaphor. But let me put it this way to extend the metaphor and play with it a little bit. A bow and an arrow, right? So a bow has two points up here and up here, and there's a string between the two. These two points are opposites that go together. Mm-hmm. Being, non-being. Mm-hmm. That's the tension of life. Being, non-being, they're not opposed to one another. And there's a string, and you have an arrow in the string, and you pull back the tension, and you fire the arrow, So instead of worrying about the bullseye, be the arrow. Where will you land? I don't know. But just be the arrow. Don't worry about hitting the bullseye. In fact, that's what they do in Zen archery. If you read about it, they're aiming kind of in the direction of the bullseye, but they're just, that practice of just letting go, allowing yourself to let go, and it fires. So just be the letting go, just be the arrow in midair. One of the going back to the Four Noble Truths being a medical metaphor and the metaphor of sickness, there's also something known as Zen sickness. And what it's referring to is when we have clear experiences or blissful kind of experiences, like say on a session or some other time, and they may be called Kensho experiences perhaps. It's best to, Robert Aitken said once, which this really resonated with me, he said it's best that we don't use these Japanese terms or foreign terms for these experiences because it inflates them into something mysterious, Kensho, Satori. He said it's better just to use a word like it's an opening. Now that really describes better in plain English what's occurring without inflating into something that seems so otherworldly. They're openings. And we all have openings in our own little way. But what Zen sickness is when we've had a little opening and some experience of bliss, and then we pine after it. And it's like, oh yeah, I remember that time when we did session in Stroud and I looked up and I saw the star and everything. And it's like, oh, I really want to go back there and experience that again. Once you're in that, you've lost it. You're not in the moment anymore. Yeah, you're dwelling in the past, right? And making a big issue out of it. Right? You're not in the moment at all. So the sickness can go both ways. You know, we can be striving for some big experience in the future out there, or we can be clinging to something happened in the past, but neither of those are the present moment, are they? Neither of those are the floorboards in front of you at the moment, or the heat in the air. Something else. It's a fantasy. It's a fragment of something. And the same thing happens, I found out, with through my psychologist's work mainly, but people who've had a lot of hallucinogenic drugs like LSD, they often have a big wonderful experience in the beginning, and then they keep on taking it to re-experience it again, and it never comes. And they keep on trying, take more LSD, bigger doses, you know, different brand, different type of hallucinogen, trying to get back to that original experience all the time. Sort of similar kind of, it's kind of an addiction. It's like a craving after something. Craving after intense experiences rather than seeing the wonder of everyday life in a calmer kind of way. So, as many of you know and we've talked about before, what is at the essence of Zen training, particularly Dogen's teaching, which we follow a lot, is the principle of no gain. Sitting is the awakened life. There's nothing outside of this that you have to gain. Just the sitting is the way. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh said, there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. You could say that about many things. There's no way to patience. Patience is the way. This is a very unusual thing for a human being to do something just for its own sake without the intention of gaining something from it. some kind of pleasure, some kind of status, some kind of security. No, very different to that. That's what makes it so simple and yet so unique. You just sit for the sake of sitting. Mm-hmm. That's it. Nothing outside of it. The English poet T.S. Eliot wrote this in one of his poems. I think it's the Four Quartets. And he could have been writing it for us. Uh-huh. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Those words could not be truer, you know, in terms of how we do this practice. And break it down doesn't mean, well, this place is all there is anyway, so why bother practicing? You know? He says, we shall not cease from exploration. We'll not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. For some reason, we all have to go on the journey of striving for something before we appreciate what's right here. But that's part of the practice. And what we drop into is suchness. So you drop out of a self-centered dream, not into some transcendent state. You drop into suchness, right? The yellow floorboards, right? Black robe, Buddha on altar, fans. That's what you drop into. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, we drop out of our conceptual framework of life into something which is just very simple, very calm, and is complete in itself. There's a bit of a sidetrack about being caught in ideals and so on. This comes mainly from my counselling work, but so many people over the years, and people who have got, you know, very responsible positions, like CEOs and people who have quite accomplished, and they tell you in the safety of a counselling session that they think they have imposter syndrome, or they have imposter syndrome, that's their diagnosis, and they really feel like they're a fake in some kind of way, and how could I possibly do this? I'm an imposter. So I reflected on it myself, and I thought, well, do I have imposter syndrome? Do I feel like an imposter? And I thought, well, you know, I'm a Zen teacher and I'm a lineage holder in a tradition. Do I feel like an imposter? And as much as I explore it in myself, the answer is no. I don't feel like an imposter. It kind of doesn't make sense to me. But if you look at it, neither do I think I'm some amazing enlightened being either, right? It's like it's getting out of all of that idealism or this idea of what you should be and then feeling like you don't live up to it. If you get out of that whole conceptual frame, it all drops away, right? And the idea of being an imposter just seems like, why ask the question, you know? Because if this practice is to come back to just being true to what you experience each moment after each moment, well, how can you be an imposter if you're just being yourself? You can't. You're just being yourself. And if you turn up to all of the anxieties and vulnerabilities that is in your experience as a human being as well, and you're true to that rather than trying to push it away to reach some ideal, then you're outside of all of that conceptual baggage that we bring around. Then it's impossible to be an imposter, right? Because you're just being who you are. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I've had people who've been practicing with me who've had some kind of breakthrough experience And then, a year later, whatever, they find themselves in a very challenging situation. Maybe it's something new they haven't experienced before, and they've got very anxious about it. They've had performance anxiety, and they've become discombobulated, and et cetera, et cetera. And then they think that all of their Zen training was for nothing, because it all fell apart in this moment. Mm-hmm. And then they might go, oh, it's not worth doing Zen practice because, you know, it's not what they made it out to be. Oh, I better get a better teacher, do you know, who might put me on the right path, or a different practice or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the point is, that situation that you went into where you became discombobulated, that was your teacher. Right there, right? Right there. Uh-huh. Amazing, you know. I've got anxious in this situation. Isn't that interesting? Can I just be that experience, with this novel experience? So our practice is always to return to suchness. It's as simple as that. And if you don't believe me, go back to the words of the Buddha. The Buddha had a philosopher once came to him. Obviously, this was quite a, not just a clever man, but a sincere man who had really reflected a lot on the nature of life and so on. And he came to the Buddha and he said quite sincerely, can you just give me the essence of your teaching, like just in a few words? And the Buddha said, well, when you see, just see. When you hear, just hear. Mm-hmm. And that was his teaching. The suchness of things as they are. Mm-hmm. Or as a Zen teacher once said, someone once asked him, what is the awakened life, or words to that effect. And he said, when you're hungry, eat, and when you're tired, sleep. And then the person said, yeah, but that's what ordinary people do. You know, anyone can do that. He said, actually, no. What ordinary people are doing is not just eating when they're hungry and sleeping when they're tired. They're creating all these kind of imaginings about their life that are all on top of it, right? And they live in that. So it's quite a different experience just to drop out of that and into the suchness of everyday life. So to end, a few words that came to mind when we were walking during the outside kin hymn this morning. The true self walks through the forest and trips over a branch on the ground. How perfect is that? Thank you.